Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Jim Grimsley, who recently visited New Orleans for the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival and Saints and Sinners, the festival for LGBT writers and friends. His new book is How I Shed My Skin, Unlearning the Racist Lessons of a Southern Childhood. We'll also hear from City Librarian and Executive Director of the New Orleans Public Library, Charles Brown, who'll tell us what's at stake in this week's millage election. Playwright and novelist Jim Grimsley is a professor at Emory University and the author of many books, including Winter Birds, Dream Boy, and My Drowning. His new memoir, just out, is called How I Shed My Skin, Unlearning the Racist Lessons of a Southern Childhood. We're visiting with Jim at the 29th Annual Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. Hi, Jim. I'm so happy to have you on The Reading Life.
It's really great to be here. Thank you for asking.
So how did you decide in the course of your work that the time was right for this book to turn to this nonfiction memoir about this very difficult subject?
I started writing this book about 6 years ago. I had been thinking about it for quite a long time and doing some reading. I guess I had the idea for the book about 20 years ago. Started reading about Eastern North Carolina, reading about the history of slavery and the Reconstruction era, the Civil Rights era. I turned to this book when I felt ready to take on a story that was nonfiction. It's probably the hardest writing project I've ever had to do. Ward came to visit us at Emory, and she had just written her memoir, and I asked her if her experience had been like mine, and she said basically it was. It was just no fun to do because I had to stop to make sure that everything I was saying was true. I had to formulate the story with the facts in mind. I had to get myself out of the fiction writer's head in which I make up things, right? So I had to be ready for that, and I had to be ready to tell a story that was very important to me, the story of how I shed my own bigotry, how I grew to confront my own racism, and that process was very difficult, so it just took a long time.
I'm curious to know if you took precautions in the writing of this book, changed names, things like that, because not everybody would like to go back and remember this time or their parts in it.
I did, in fact, change all of the names in the book because I did not want to feel like I had to deal with the guilt of calling some of my, you know, these were my childhood friends. And even the people who stopped being my friends after the integration process got underway, I felt like I had to honor the fact that I was not really trying to call them names. I was not trying to out them as bigots. I was trying to talk about my own process of moving to what I call a state of being a recovering racist. Mm-hmm. One of the fallacies, one of the flaws I see all the time in my friends who try to talk about this issue is that one of the first things they'll say, my white friends, is, I'm not a racist. It's something I mentioned, I spent some time on in the book. That's not a genuine statement. There's not a lot of white people who can say, I don't have any racist programming in me. What they're trying to say is, I don't commit overt racist acts. And that's a distinction that I try to talk about in the book. We all have that programming in us, nearly all of us. So the best we're actually going to be able to do is to recover from that. So I tried to honor that when I was talking about my past and to protect the people that I did not want to harm in the writing of the book. So changing the names, that's all I changed, though. I did not change any of the facts. I didn't change the incidents. So the story is as true as I could make it, but it's also as empathetic as I can make it, both to the white kids and to the black kids that I dealt with at that time.
So set the scene for us. I wonder if you'd read this beautifully descriptive passage of the place where you grew up.
Sure. To say that our lives were quiet is not to claim that they were simple in any way. In the quiet places of the world, human nature becomes convoluted, spreads out to claim more space for its twistings, and makes knots of the Gordian variety. The countryside and its beauty sheltered much that could be described as Gothic and hid many a blemish. Old houses fell down into heaps of lumber, overgrown with weeds and vines, while next door or in the backyard the family parked a mobile home or built a new cinder block house. Yards overflowed with old appliances and rusted cars. Torn screens hung from porches on a house crying for paint, unlikely to be soothed. Old tobacco curing barns collapsed or leaned to the side next to the metal-sheathed bulk curers that dried tobacco much faster. The past collapsed and decayed even as the future replaced it. One fine plantation house on the road to Trenton still stood during my childhood, and we passed it often enough that I remember it, a white-columned structure down a long lane lined with oaks. I would learn much later that the house had originally been quite modest, a one-story frame farmhouse, but the owners had long ago, likely after the Civil War, raised it by one floor and added a neoclassical porch. The Simmons family, who lived in the house, owned many square miles of land thereabouts, parking a private plane behind trees on one side. On the other side of the house stood a row of what were rumored to be old slave cabins, and we pointed these out to each other over and over again as we passed them. That is where the slaves lived, we would say, as if this were an important fact to remember. So it was that a ride through the country could show me something of the hierarchy in which we lived, rich and poor, black and white. Geography provided a lesson in who was high and who was low. I marveled at the thought that somebody could own and fly a plane, and there it was, behind a row of trees. But I hardly blinked at the thought that the same family had once owned slaves. I do not remember a time when this fact was new to me. It was part of the background, something I had learned earlier than memory.
I love that. I love that passage so much. Now, in addition to putting us down in this precise geography, you talk a lot about the social landscape of the time and the images that brought us to where we were. Now, I know you were a Monkees fan, which you had to fess up to. So talk about some of those images that shaped, you know, racial consciousness for you. And then your friends, Rhonda and Ursula and Violet, brought in a whole new set of images for you to take in as well.
That question of Southern place I tried to talk about in the book. We talk about a Southerner's relationship to place repeatedly in conversations about Southern writing. And what I tried to point out was that we talk about it as landscape, but we don't usually talk about knowing your place, you know, knowing your social position in the community. So that's important in the book, to deal with the fact that the South is a hierarchy. People are high and people are low. People are good and worthwhile if they have money, if they have status, and people are trash if they are shiftless and lazy and don't own anything. Yes, I was a Monkees fan and a Star Trek fan. And these are the years when both those were new things to be. My friend Marianne and I talked to each other constantly about the Monkees because we were both, you know, I was gay. She didn't really know that. Nobody knew it because I hadn't really come out to anybody, but I was totally in love with Davy Jones and at the same time in love with Captain Jim Kirk of the Starship Enterprise. When Rhonda and Violet in particular entered the classroom, we formed a very quick friendship after an initial incident that I describe in the book that was pretty dramatic for me when I called one of the girls, Ursula, a name, and she spat back at me really quickly and put me in my place in a way that showed me that she was completely equal to me, whether I liked that or not. They brought into that classroom a whole culture of ideas. They would bring in Ebony magazine, and I would look at the pages of Ebony, and there were images of middle-class black people, upper-class black people, very well-dressed people, people wearing suits. And they were astonishing to me because I simply hadn't been exposed to black people and images of cultured black people at all. I had my idea of a black person was like my idea of a poor white farmer, you know, people wearing overalls, people not wearing shoes in the summertime. I mean, this is the era in which people during the summer shed as many clothes as they could, whether they were black or white, because the heat was so unbearable. So my images were all of country people. On TV, I picked up images of citified white people, but not of black people. So it was the introduction of these magazines into my life that first gave me the idea that there were actually urban black people out there who were not country people and who were just like white people.
And also, Rhonda and Ursula and Violet, whom I love their names, they pushed you into awareness of soul, yes, and of the Black Power movement, in which you found inspiration as well.
There was an incident I describe in the book where somebody said something to one of them and it ticked them all off. And in unison, they stood up and they started doing their, you know, say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. And they chanted the lyrics of this James Brown song and they did a dance. You know, they didn't rehearse this at all. They didn't even look at each other. They just fell into the same steps of the same dance. So it was clearly something that was in their lives. It was in their community. And I was just completely flabbergasted by it. You know, white kids didn't do that kind of thing. They didn't stand up. They didn't sing. They didn't dance. These three girls introduced me to this really crucial idea of soul, and they embodied what soul meant. You know, I don't know who came up with the idea of soul, but it's a brilliant, brilliant piece of propaganda for the time, because soul was something that black people had that white people didn't have necessarily, although they were willing to agree that some white people had it. And if Rhonda or Violet liked you, they'd tell you you had a little bit of soul. They also introduced me to the notion of the revolution. I mean, that was a big thing to talk about in the 60s, that black people were going to rise up and take power into their own hands. And there were a couple of times when Rhonda told me that she'd see to it I got put on the list, that I'd be one of the white people who wasn't killed during the revolution, so I didn't have anything to worry about. You know, and this is 11-year-olds talking, so, you know, it had that level of sort of fantasy reality that we gave to everything.
And talk about how this process was also important to you as a gay man, as a gay boy, really.
Their being willing to expose the fact that they were different to us, I mean, and what I mean is different from white people, different in our eyes. Their courage in standing up in our classroom and showing us what blackness was all about began to give me the courage to own the side of myself that I knew was different from other people also. Later in high school, the fact that I was going to high school with so many black kids, it destroyed the old white hierarchy that would have been in place in high school. Meant that I was teased much less about being a sissy, which I was. It made my life much easier because there was not a unified white community to insist that I date somebody, that I pretend to be a straight person, that I toe the line in that way. That kind of high school culture had vanished, had been shattered by the coming of integration. And so instead of being a kid on the margins trying to hide my gayness, I was one of the popular kids in the circle of kids that mixed, you know, the hippie kids, the kids who had interracial friendships. That's not to say that I dared to come out at the time, because I didn't. I don't think either community would have liked it if I had. But the fact that these folks were willing to claim their equality for themselves and to claim the power of themselves gave me the courage by the time I got to college to do the same thing for myself. Their claiming of their freedom gave me the guts to make the first steps to claiming my own.
And you became a good dancer along the way, which I also liked reading about. Now, one of the things I want you to talk about is, what did composing this book do for you as a person? What is the take home for you from having explored this part of your life?
In the end, what it's given me is a very rich sense of how much the world has changed and how much it stayed the same. I tried very hard to speak of race as I knew it when I was 11 and the way that I evolved from an 11-year-old to someone graduating from high school. At the time, I wouldn't have been able to articulate these issues the way that I've tried to do in the book, but I knew everything that I've stated in the book in my heart. I knew that I had this racist programming in me. I knew it wasn't going to go away. I knew I needed to be careful never to act on it. I needed to be a good friend to all my friends, regardless of who they were. And I needed to be a sensitive member of the majority race in every circumstance that I fell into as a college student. What writing the book taught me beyond all that was the history and the context. And it confirmed my instincts that this issue of race was predominant, was pervasive in white culture.
Well, it's just an exquisite book, Jim, and such an important one. And one of the things I love most about it is that it has this fresh perspective, this sense of a child's eye view of the world, and it keeps it relatable, completely relatable, and it's just a very beautiful piece of work, so thank you.
Thank you very much. That's what I was trying to do.
We've been talking with Jim Grimsley, whose new book is How I Shed My Skin, Unlearning the Racist Lessons of a Southern Childhood, and he's debuting that book here at the 29th Annual Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. Thank you so much.
I so appreciate your asking me to be on the show.
When the world and I were young, just yesterday, life was such a simple game a child could play. It was easy then to tell right from wrong, easy then to tell weak from strong. When a man should stand and fight or just go along. But today there is no day or night. Today
Charles Brown is the executive director of the New Orleans Public Library, and it's always good to check in with him and see how things are going at the library. Our system faces its fair share of challenges, as you know, and there's an important election coming up May 2nd, and I think we all need to have a good sense of what's at stake. Charles Brown, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. Great to be here. Great to see you.
Always, always. Take us back a bit to what the library was like when you first came to New Orleans, what our system was like.
Well, first of all, the library is very much in a rebuilding phase. When I returned, there were 5 replacement libraries that were nearing completion. Unfortunately, the ship was
listing,
yes, because there had not been consistent leadership since before Hurricane Katrina. And, you know, that meant that, you know, there had been 6 years. I want to say it was rudderless, but there were a lot of challenges that the library system faced. And I think the library board and elected officials in the city have gone a long way to support the new leadership of the library. And I think we're definitely on the right track now to be a very successful, you know, organization.
You probably had the only librarian job that should have come with a hard hat. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, oh. But historically, and I know you've done so much research on this, the New Orleans Public Library has faced financial challenges through its whole existence, hasn't
it? That's true. I did some research for the city council last fall during our budget hearing. And working with Irene Wainwright, who at the time, you know, headed up our Louisiana division, we traced a 100-year history of underfunding for the New Orleans Public Library. I can recall that in 1910, when New Orleans and Newark, New Jersey had comparable populations, I think we spent about 1/10 of what Newark was spending on its public library. I always knew that New Orleans was a major city. I had forgotten that for most of its history, it's been the largest, most progressive, most, you know, cosmopolitan city in the entire South. And that was especially true during the 1930s when it was twice as large as Houston and Atlanta. And yet they were spending 25 to 50% more on their public library than we were spending here in New Orleans. So library funding, unfortunately, has never been a high priority, you know, here in the city. And it reached a crisis point in 1986 because for the first 90 years of the library's history, it had been a part of the city government funding stream. So the library was fully supported by the city's general fund. And when the city hit on hard times in the mid-80s, consideration was given to closing the branch libraries in the city of New Orleans, which would have been unprecedented.
Catastrophic.
And, yes, in 20th century America. At that point in time, the Business Council was actually formed around this issue and supported the library until a ballot measure could go before the people, and that was to have a dedicated millage for the support of the New Orleans Public Library. And that four mills was passed overwhelmingly. I think there was a 72% plurality in terms of the support for that 1986 ballot measure.
Wow. And now, in the post-Katrina era, we face financial challenges that are even more extreme.
What has happened? I've learned a lot during this process of preparing for, you know, the information campaign that the library is spearheading. And as a homeowner, you may recall that after Hurricane Katrina, there was a decision made to roll back some millage rates because there was concern about the city, you know, people returning. There was a concern that people who were here needed as much tax relief as possible to make it feasible for them to remain here. And so the library's millage was rolled back over a full mill to 3.14. It had moved up over the years from 4, which was the amount passed by the populace in 1986, to 4.32 right before the storm. And it was rolled back to 3.14 following the storm when the library was down to 19 employees at one point.
Right.
So it had really shrunk from over 200 to 19. But at any rate, we remain at that 3.14 funding level at a time that we have rebuilt most of the system. We have one remaining library to rebuild. That's Nora Navra in the 7th Ward. But we have depleted. We are nearing the point where we've had to depend on our reserves, which built up following the storm, and the library had downsized. We had something like $12 million in reserves in as recently as 2011. And then as the new larger libraries opened, we began to have to draw down on the reserves about $3 million per year. So at the beginning of this calendar year, we had $4.5 million in reserves, which augmented the little over $9 million that we received through the designated millage revenue. At the rate we're going, sometime next year, probably mid-year 2016, our reserves will be depleted, and we will immediately lose 26%, over a quarter of our funding. And so that's the reason for this request for additional funding in the form of a 2.5 millage. In addition to also stabilizing the library's funding situation, we also want to enhance our service levels. And one of the key things would be our hours of operation. We are below state standard in hours of operation of our public libraries. And to give you an example, our downtown main library is open 46 hours a week. Its counterpart in Baton Rouge, the central library there, is open 84 hours a week.
84.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that gives you some idea of how far behind we are in terms of hours of service. Most of our locations are only open 5 days a week. And so with the successful passage of this millage, we would have 6 libraries open 7 days a week, and all other libraries would be open 6 days a week in the city of New Orleans. And so we're very excited about that.
And if not, it's going to be bad.
Yes.
It's going to be bad.
We're looking at a variety of options. None of them are good.
Yeah.
You know, from the closing of libraries to the dramatic reduction in hours of operation, perhaps to stop buying most of our library materials, which we're buying in all kinds of formats now, as I'm sure your listeners know.
You know, right.
We have not only traditional print, but ebooks. We've got downloadable audio and video. We just got a new online magazine service called Flipster that I think we're launching. So there's a lot going on at the library in terms of a variety of formats that we have to buy. None of them are cheap, and so there are just more and more of them.
And so you have the actual physical libraries, and you have the virtual library.
Yes.
Plus, the physical libraries are just so much fun when you go.
Right,
you know,
yes.
Summer's coming. We got to keep those kiddos busy and reading.
I agree.
So.
And we had a record-breaking summer reading program last year that also involved teens and adults. Mm.
So it just drives me nuts, truthfully, that we're at the bottom of every list in our own state.
Yeah. I also prepared a chart for the city council that showed that on a per capita basis, we are at the bottom in the metropolitan area. We're at the bottom in the state of Louisiana among libraries serving 100,000 residents or more. We looked at selected cities in the South, and we were at the bottom. You know, we compared ourselves with Mobile, Birmingham, Little Rock. And then we looked at cities with high poverty levels, you know, like New Orleans. And we were at the bottom behind Gary, Indiana, Detroit, Michigan, Newark, New Jersey, Cleveland, Ohio, So, you know, we're batting 1,000 in that regard.
We got to appeal to Civic Pride. Yeah. Now, you're in a really interesting position with this whole information campaign because that's really all you can do
is
present information.
Right.
You can't tell people how to vote.
That's correct.
So
that's correct.
We can only make it possible for people to vote.
And if any of your listeners really want very detailed information about the millage and what it would accomplish, they can go to the library's website, and we have comprehensive information there. But again, we can just provide information. That's it.
And all the branches have these great brochures that explain what the funding would make possible.
Right.
So fingers crossed,
Thank
Charles.
You. Thank
man,
you.
I tell you. Well, everyone who listens to The Reading Life knows a great city deserves great libraries. So May 2nd, vote your conscience. We've been talking with Charles Brown, the executive director of the New Orleans Public Library. Charles, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. John Taylor discusses and signs Wings Over New Orleans, Unseen Photos of Paul and Linda McCartney, 1975. Tuesday, April 28th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Poets Melinda Palacio and Jose Torres Tama read from their work in honor of National Poetry Month. Wednesday, April 29th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Troy Trombone Shorty Andrews debuts his new children's book, and it is a beauty, illustrated by Brian Collier. It's called Trombone Shorty, and it debuts at Shorty Fest, a musical showcase of emerging talent, which takes place Thursday, April 30th at 7 at Generations Hall. Tickets are available at eventsprout.com. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses The Asylum, True Tales of Madness from a Life in Fashion by Simon Doonan. Tuesday, May 5th at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop. Newcomers, always welcome. Sally Michelle Jackson, a local author and musician, discusses her new book, The Darkness Survives, The Heilsing Cases, Volume 2. Tuesday, May 5th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Chris Chambers, who directs the Walker Percy Center for Writing and Publishing at Loyola and whose new book is Delta 88, is the featured reader in the student-run 1718 reading series, Tuesday, May 5th at 7 at the Columns Hotel, 3811 St. Charles Avenue. Jazz Fest book signings are coming up again. Check out the Book Tent, which is operated by volunteers from the New Orleans Gulf South Booksellers Association, with proceeds going to local literacy efforts. It's next to the CD and Record Tent. Here's the schedule. Thursday, April 30th is Locals Day. From 1 to 2, Bill Lofeld signs Doing the Devil's Work. From 2 to 3, Leif Peterson signs Adventures of Swamp Kids, a Zoo to Do. From 3 to 4, Richard Campanella, Lost New Orleans. Friday, May 1st, from 1 to 2, Bernie Cook, Flood of Images. From 3 to 4, Guy Lyman III, A Big E.C. Childhood. And from 4 to 5, Dennis McNally, On Highway 61, Race, Music, and the Evolution of Cultural Freedom. Saturday, May 2nd, from noon to 1, M.O. Walsh, My Sunshine Away. 1 to 2, Cornell Landry, Goodnight Cajun Land. 2 to 3, Michael Petrie, Fives and 25s. 3 to 4, Troy Andrews and Brian Collier, Trombone Shorty. And Sunday, May 3rd, from 1 to 2, Brian Boyles, New Orleans Boom and Blackout. And 2 to 3, Johnette Downing signs Fee Foley. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.